Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this day before Thanksgiving. We're going to talk politics this hour, so you'll be sure and have something to talk about around the Thanksgiving table tomorrow. We have a terrific book and a great guest with us this hour. Mark Halperin is the co-author of Double Down, Game Change 2012. It's a sequel to Game Change 2008. And he has thought long and hard about the 2012 race and also thought about the 2008 race as well, and interviewed hundreds of people for this book. And so we're going to talk about a whole lot of them this hour of the program. Mark is an editor-at-large and senior political analyst for Time Magazine, a senior political analyst for MSNBC, and he has covered seven presidential elections. And we should say he's co-author of this book with John Heilemann. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I would think we'll have more than a few unless you're all on the road somewhere this afternoon as we look at the 2012 campaign and election. Our number is 800-486-8255. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and you can always go to Twitter, which I tend to forget, but you can go there, and that's at K Dunn Show. Mark, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Kathleen, great to be here. Happy holidays to you and all your listeners.
And happy Thanksgiving to you. What will you do tomorrow?
I will go to Washington, D.C., where I grew up, and spend some time with my family, maybe.
Great. And do you talk politics at the Thanksgiving table?
Mostly we talk about nephews and nieces and what's going on with them, not too much politics.
Good. That's good. I want to start with, because I found this, well, the whole book is fascinating to me, but I had no idea that the president was, as you describe him, an inveterate list maker. He loved sitting down with a yellow legal pad and filling up pages with his thoughts. It helped him to quiet his mind. So in preparation for the 2012 campaign, he was told, well, why don't you come up with some ideas? So he comes up with this incredibly long list. And I must say, I was surprised to read what was on that list. It really was kind of a, here is the progressive President Obama, who had a lot of things that he didn't accomplish in the first term that were still important to him.
It's quite a dramatic scene. It's when John Heilemann and I really think kind of helps to tell the story of the president's relationship as being simultaneously an incumbent president and also someone running for re-election. He made the list about a year before Election Day in 2011. His political team was meeting in a series of meetings in the White House to talk about how to run for re-election as an incumbent. And the president made up a list after being encouraged to sort of talk about, organize his thoughts about what he cared most about. And the list is kind of a list of regrets, kind of a list of things he's sort of thinking about for a second term. And as you suggested, the elements of it were largely things that progressives care about. And of course, there's always been, since he's been in national life, a debate about Barack Obama. Is he a progressive, a liberal? Is he more of a post-ideological centrist? And on this list was things like his support for same-sex marriage, which he hadn't announced publicly then, but he told the group in the room he was for, fighting poverty, dealing with climate change, dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict, dealing with Guantanamo Bay, a handful of other issues, immigration, that largely the president was saying that he had to govern with the foot on the brake, that he had not been able to say everything he wanted to say, and again, was kind of musing about his frustration about that fact and kind of weighing in on the notion of if he did get reelected, perhaps he'd be able to move this agenda more than he was in the first term.
And he's giving this list in front of a fairly large group of people. It's the first time you say that he had been expressing these kinds of thoughts to that many people. And I think it was Daley's response, boy, I hope this list never gets out.
Yeah, this was, as I suggested, the early on in these series of political meetings that he was having. And it was a much larger group than the president normally confided in amongst his both White House staff and the political staff. He'd been warned by David Plouffe, his campaign manager from 2008 and senior White House advisor in this instance, that the large group was a real danger, that you couldn't keep a secret in a large group that large. As it happened, shortly after the president shared the list, which he'd done after telling everybody in these meetings that the meetings had to be confidential for him to trust everybody, shortly after he read the list, the list was shared to us, with us, John Heilemann and myself, in conjunction with our reporting for the book. And when the president was told that we had the list, he was quite upset about it. He felt betrayed and hurt and angry that after warning everybody these meetings needed to be confidential, the list was shared. And there's a subsequent meeting, which was occurred right after he was told that the list had leaked, in which the president, quite angry and betrayed, as I said, told everyone how he felt, said the meetings wouldn't be able to continue at that size, and then stormed out of the room, followed shortly thereafter by a soliloquy from Vice President Biden, who also walked out of the room. John Holman and I, as best we know from our reporting, it's the only double POTUS v. POTUS walkout in White House history.
What's in it for somebody to betray this kind of confidentiality? What do they get out of it?
Well, keep in mind that the list was shared with us explicitly for the book, and all of our interviews done during the campaign and after the campaign, after Election Day, are done, are embargoed until the book comes out a year after Election Day. So people aren't doing anything that would might jeopardize the president's chances of winning the election or not. Generally, people cooperate with us. They trust us. They know us. John and I have been political reporters for a long time. We reported Game Change and did 300 interviews with about 200 people. This book, we did 500 interviews
Wow.
with about 400 people. And they tend to be people, as I say, who we've known for a long time, who want to tell their stories and want to make sure that John and I get it right in these books, not just the facts, which obviously are paramount in terms of accuracy, but also kind of the feel and smell and taste of what it's like inside a presidential campaign at the highest level.
Right. Well, you do a fine job of doing that. Let's talk about Guantanamo for a moment. He said, the president, no one is going to persuade me that we should run a penal colony in perpetuity in America. Why is that such a difficult issue? And it goes on and on and on. Controversy about it, people going on hunger strikes so many years after 9/11. What is it with the perpetuation of a penal colony?
Well, great question, and Kathleen, the divisions in this country that maybe dissipated to some extent after 9/11 came right back, and there's just a strong belief on the part of a lot of Republicans and many Democrats that closing Guantanamo would be a bad idea, that there's no good place to put the people who are still held there. People don't want to return them or set them free or give them to some other country. They don't want to bring them back to the United States because there's nowhere in the United States that people really want them. Some people are concerned if they're brought back to the United States, they'd be afforded more due process rights than they would get if they were tried in Guantanamo. So it's been an extraordinary frustration of the president, who pledged that he would close the facility and get all the prisoners out of there, but he's not been able to do it. Now, there's always an argument when the president doesn't get his way with Congress whether he did everything he could. But my sense is public opinion is such that he couldn't do it. But as you cited in that meeting where he was reading the list, great frustration, because from his point of view as a constitutional scholar, he just doesn't think there should be, as we quote him as saying, a permanent penal colony in the United States.
What about his position on gay marriage? The public posture you write on the issue, his had been all over the map. How early did he come to the determination that there should be gay marriage, and what were his thoughts about Joe Biden coming out in favor of it before he did?
All good questions. This is a part of the book that we thought would get more attention than it has so far. And we're grateful for the attention the book has gotten. But our narrative of how the president eventually came out publicly for same-sex marriage, we think, has not been told before. And it's a pretty revealing story about the president in terms of political calculation, in terms of kind of his inner compass. As we report in the book, I believe for the first time, the president was telling people all the way back in 2004 that he was supported same-sex marriage. But then as a national candidate, felt that he couldn't politically have that position because it wasn't at that point nearly as accepted as it is now. And so he developed in the White House this notion that he was evolving. And we chronicle kind of his hide-and-seek attempt to avoid being asked a question that would sort of force his hand and have him reveal his position. At the same time, the president made it clear to his aides around the same time I was talking about before, and 2011, that he was going to have to come out for gay marriage before the election. He thought it was important to do before the election, in part because he thought it would come up in the debates, and he didn't want to give an untruthful answer in the debate, and in part because if he got reelected, which he expected to, and then came out for same-sex marriage, he felt voters could justifiably accuse him of not being straightforward about where he was on an issue. At the same time, besides being worried about the political factor of a potential backlash with some groups if he came out for same-sex marriage. The president, I think, made a pretty shrewd judgment, which was public opinion was moving in the way he wanted it to. And that if he came out for it publicly, it would politicize the issue. It would kind of become an Obama crusade as opposed to a kind of naturally occurring social movement and change in social mores. And so he was reluctant to make himself part of the story. But as you alluded to, Vice President Biden went on Meet the Press and got a little bit ahead of the president at the time when the president was on the cusp of making his announcement public. And the vice president suggested he himself was for same-sex marriage, and that moved the president's timing up in a way that some of his advisors got angry at Joe Biden and were worried that the president's announcement would seem anticlimactic. Instead, I think the president got a fair amount of political benefit out of doing it because it inspired not just the gay and lesbian groups, but also young people and some others who applauded his decision and his political courage, such as it was under the circumstances. Mm-hmm. And I think they believe it was a net plus rather than being worried that it might hurt his chances of being reelected.
Mm-hmm. We've heard the vice president talk about how smart this president is. Your book bears that out in comments that Biden has made, really almost self-deprecating comments, where he's talking about how this president can grasp information in a way that he, Joe Biden, wouldn't be able to.
Joe Biden wouldn't be able to about, I'm sorry, missed
that,
the topic.
That he really admires the intellect of the president and really considers him perhaps smarter than he is, Joe Biden is.
Yes, it's interesting. You know, one of the things John and I try to do, we did in Game Change, we do in Double Down, is write about politicians not so much as, you know, political animals and deep policy discussion, to say the least, but about their relationships with their spouses, with their colleagues. So the Clintons and the Obamas are an important relationship in our book. Governor Romney and Governor Christie, an important relationship. The relationship between the president and Joe Biden are really important. Joe Biden and the president, as we write about in Game Change, in the Senate together, there was a little bit of tension between them. When the president, during the first campaign and then in the early days of the White House, there was some tension. But they've really bonded. And the vice president, we have a scene in the book, which I think you're referring to, in which he was just dazzled after a conference call in which the president kind of asked a lot of extraordinarily well-informed and analytical questions. The vice president, you know, said, "I couldn't have done that." Came to believe not that he would have been the better president, which he did in 2008 when he ran against Barack Obama, but that the president was, in his view, a great president, and he was proud to serve with him and regularly sort of have his back and tell people, both overseas leaders as well as members of Congress, not to underestimate Barack Obama.
Mm-hmm. And the two of them have become really friends, haven't they?
They have, you know, somewhat to their surprise. There's a colorful exchange between them in the book that I won't repeat here, but both expressed surprise to each other that they in fact had become friends. Their wives had become friends, and the president, one of the president's daughters, plays on a basketball team at a school in Washington with one of the vice president's granddaughters, and so there's a closeness to them. One of the kind of ironies of the situation is, though, although they have become better friends politically, there's been a real tilt, both in the re-election campaign and now in the post-re-election period, there's been a real tilt by the Obama political team towards the Clintons. And when people start talking about 2016, the perception, at least, is that the president's team has kind of married up with the Clintons' team, advantaging Hillary Clinton rather than maybe doing what some might think, which is helping the president's friend Joe Biden try to figure out a way to become the front runner.
When did President Obama find it necessary to really get the support and get Bill Clinton to work for him? Clinton said some pretty nasty things about Obama and race issues, actually, during the 2008 campaign. I would think that would stay somewhere in the president's mind.
Well, again, this is a kind of a continuity between the first book, between Game Change and between Double Down, which is tracing the relationship between these two guys. There's no question that there was some roughness between them in 2008, to say the least, and President Clinton, President Obama campaigned together at one event in 2008, and really President Clinton was not asked by the Obama folks to be a major force in the general election. The reality is that in the period that I was talking about before, about a year before Election Day, in the fall of 2011, President Obama did something he rarely does. He admitted to other people that he needed some help, specifically from Bill Clinton. Up until that point, he hadn't consulted him very much. Now, what made it relatively easy for Barack Obama to change course on this is that he's not a kind of guy who holds grudges. He's a pretty live-and-let guy, forgive-and-forget kind of guy. And when he decided, with the advice of his aides, that he really needed Bill Clinton on his team, in order to get reelected, he started to court him and invited him to play golf, which went okay. It didn't go great. Afterwards, one of the President Obama asked the president what he liked Bill Clinton, what he thought of him, and he said, "I like him in doses." And that was kind of a symbolic start in the sense that President Obama made the gesture and they played golf, but he didn't come away totally enamored. But over the course of the year, they did get closer, and President Obama would see on occasion at private fundraisers President Clinton giving speeches on his behalf that just blew him away in terms of how praising they were and how articulate. And then President Obama did something that President Clinton appreciated and which benefited President Obama. He asked him to kind of anchor that middle night of the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. The First Lady spoke on the first night, President Clinton on the second night, President Obama on the third night. And that speech, as I'm sure all your informed listeners recall, was really one of the better political speeches of the last several years, at least.
Yes, it was.
And made just a huge difference, according to Governor Romney's pollster and other observers, in the outcome. And by Election Day, the two are very close. President Obama and President Clinton are so close that after President Obama gets the concession phone call from Mitt Romney conceding the outcome, the very first call President Obama made was to Bill Clinton to thank him for all his help.
What was the occasion? I know you write about this. I just can't remember what brought Bill Clinton to the podium for the press conference. And he just, I'm just going to say a few words. And just like Bill Clinton, he goes on and on and on.
Yeah.
Why did he do that? I forgot.
It's another scene that sort of, again, is sort of a point along the way in the arc of their relationship and their coming together. This was during one of the budget fights after the lame duck session. This goes back to 2010 after the midterm elections, when President Obama had done so poorly, the Democrats had done so poorly, and they were trying to strike a budget deal on taxes, and a lot of Democrats in Congress were wavering about whether to support the president's position. And so President Clinton and President Obama came into the White House briefing room together, and President Clinton made the case for the deal, which swayed a lot of Democrats and allowed the bill to pass. And famously, although President Obama had to go off to a holiday party, President Clinton, as he'd stay for just a bit, and ended up saying, people won't be surprised, quite a bit, to talk at length, enjoying the spotlight of being back being back in there. And you know, the spotlight, Bill Clinton is just an incredible political performer, and one of the reasons he came to be grateful to President Obama, despite the fact that President Obama obviously had a lot of gratitude to President Clinton, was because he let him go out and campaign. President Clinton had campaigned for his own reelection in 1996. In 2000, Al Gore thought that Clinton fatigue was such that he didn't want Bill Clinton out there very much. In 2004, there was John Kerry was the nominee. He really wanted Bill Clinton out there, but he'd had some heart surgery, so he missed that. And then, of course, in 2008, President Obama did not want Bill Clinton out there. So this was really the first time since 1996 when he had a chance to go out. So just as he enjoyed the spotlight on that day in the briefing room and talking about the tax deal, he enjoyed being out on the campaign trail around the country on President Obama's behalf. And so it was a deal, as we say in Arkansas, that worked out for both of them.
Mm-hmm. We have to talk about Mitt Romney, and we'll do so in just a moment. A lot of the book, a lot of the press surrounding the book has been about the vetting of Chris Christie, who was thought of as a potential vice presidential running mate for Mitt Romney. Maybe he would have done better with Chris Christie, but there were some problems that surfaced and probably will surface again. I'm sure that if Chris Christie decides to run, that vetting process, which raised some red flags, will be front and center in the campaign. And we in Wisconsin have substantial questions about how Paul Ryan was picked and whether or not why Mitt Romney picked him and whether or not that was helpful to the campaign. Did Romney have a tin ear for privilege? And we got to talk about Clint Eastwood. You know, how did that happen? The authors write about that in their book as well. Mark Halperin is our guest. The book is Double Down, Game Change 2012. Mark is an editor-at-large, senior political analyst for Time Magazine, senior political analyst for MSNBC. He's covered all kinds of presidential elections and really is a superb political reporter. The book is fun to read as well as being highly informative because he and his co-author interviewed some 500 100 people. Here's our phone number. We sure welcome your participation this hour. The number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave some messages for us on our Facebook page, which is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Lines are open for you at this very moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. The author, one of the authors of Double Down, Game Change 2012, Mark Halperin, is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls from Mark at 800-486-8655. Starting our calls with Bill in Beloit. Hi, Bill.
Hi. I've read the book, and it is a very fun read. I was hoping the author could speak more about what effect Paul Ryan had in the whole race, because it seemed like the Mitt Romney campaign, it was just this obvious choice, but that President Obama was really surprised by the book.
Mark.
Thank you for your nice words about the book. The president was surprised. His team thought that Paul Ryan wouldn't be picked for the same reason Paul Ryan wouldn't be picked. Right in the book, Congressman Ryan told people he didn't think he'd be picked, as the phrase he used was, "I have a lot of sharp knives in my drawer," meaning his positions on budget and tax issues, that while he believes in them, he knows they're politically controversial. But Governor Romney, we write in the book, wanted a pick, someone who would be seen as qualified to be president by the media and by the public. And Congressman Ryan, despite his age and the lack of executive experience, was seen that way uniformly. No one raised that question about whether he was qualified or not to be a heartbeat away from the presidency. I think that was a little bit surprising to me. Not that I don't think he's a talented and bright guy, but given his age, I thought perhaps some might raise that, but they didn't. And Governor Romney wanted someone he got along with personally, and well remarked that at the time, the personal chemistry between them out on the campaign trail. And also, he wanted someone to be a good governing partner. He wanted someone who knew Congress, which Governor Romney doesn't know particularly well. All those things added up to leaning towards the Ryan pick. And to some extent, those controversial budget issues, since Governor Romney had endorsed most of the provisions of the Ryan budget, his campaign felt broad support for Governor Ryan, Congressman Ryan, amongst Governor Romney's staff, with a few exceptions. They felt that he would be a good spokesman for those controversial positions and help Governor Romney fight against the president on those issues. In the end, they didn't emphasize those issues very much. The message was not about Medicare reform. It wasn't not discussed at all, but it really wasn't central to the campaign. And Congressman Ryan was a bit frustrated by that. He thought if they were going to pick him, that those things should be more front and center. I don't think he had a huge impact on the race, but generally running mates don't have a huge impact. They simply, if you make a bad pick, it can cost you. If you make a good pick, people sort of check the box and move on.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. They certainly could not have believed that Wisconsin was in play, or did they?
Well, the Republicans had a bit of an electoral college challenge in the sense that they weren't doing much to expand the map. They were mostly trying to win states that President Obama had won in 2008, and they needed to find some places to break through. In the end, they didn't win any battleground states, with the exception of North Carolina, and I think Wisconsin was a place Republicans, Karl Rove, really wanted to win it with President Bush, both in 2000 and 2004. And I think, Congressman Ryan, besides having some strength, obviously, in his own congressional district, they thought a favorite son there might give them a little bit of a help in Wisconsin. And there were times when their polling showed that it did. But I don't think they had the highest hopes for Wisconsin, but I don't think they ruled it out by any means. And you never know what happens when you put a favorite son on the candidate. He might have made a bigger difference than he ended up doing.
Yeah. Let's talk about Chris Christie. Another part of the book that's made a lot of headlines is the vetting process for Chris Christie and some ethical concerns about him and some health concerns about him, which I'm sure that vetting process is going to be very much examined if he decides to run in 2016, don't you think?
Kathy, no doubt about it. And we need to look further than Governor Christie, who, when asked about some of the things in the book that were factors in the vice presidential selection process, he said, if I run for president, I'm sure I'll have to deal with those things. Many of them are things that are in the public record, but not very well known. Governor Christie's worked as a lobbyist, for instance, for the securities organization, and at the time that group was headed by the Bernie Madoff. And so that 30-second ad sort of writes itself in the view of Governor Romney's background vetting team. you know, Governor Christie did not turn everything over in a timely fashion to Governor Romney's team, which aroused their suspicion. And some of the things he did turn over made them uncomfortable. Information about his health, information about lawsuits and investigations of Governor Christie, and then this issue about Bernie Madoff. So all that added up to, from Governor Romney's point of view, although he sees a lot of strengths in Chris Christie, as do a lot of voters, thought it was just too controversial a pick. He wanted a pick that would be exciting, but not necessarily generate a lot of controversy. And he was worried that some of these things in Governor Christie's background could take off in a negative way.
Who was it who said this about Romney, that he seemed, and this seemed to play out in the whole campaign, he just, yeah, all the houses and the dog on the top of the car and this tin ear for privilege, that seems to be spot on in terms of how he was perceived. Is that a valid criticism of him? And was it what ultimately did him in that election?
Well, I think you can make an argument that is what ultimately did it in. The overwhelming result of people who said the most important issue for them between President Obama and Governor Romney was, who cares about people like me? Governor Romney lost that vote overwhelmingly and won in a lot of other sort of choices. So I think that really did hurt him, and I think Governor Romney was his own worst enemy in terms of making a number of gaffes, not just the famous remark about 47% of the country, but remarks about his wife owning two Cadillacs and saying he likes to fire people. He doesn't care about poor people. Most of these things were innocent remarks, and even the 47% thing Governor Romney felt was an unfair thing to hang around his neck. But there's no doubt that he reinforced the image of being an out-of-touch rich guy, and his record at Bain Capital was also another problem along those lines. He's a very nice man, and people who know him well really like and respect him. He's given a large amounts of money to charity. And I find him, you know, I don't know him all particularly well, but I've spent some time with him. I find him to be at some distance to what his public image is. At the same time, part of running for president, if you get elected being president, involves projecting yourself in a favorable way towards the public at large. And Governor Romney does not have much of a gift for that. We cite a remark Bill Clinton was making to people around the time of the 47% comment about Governor Romney, who he likes quite a bit. President Clinton said, he's a very nice man. He's in a long line of work. He shouldn't have a job where he's forced to speak to people in public.
Interesting. And perhaps they thought that, let's contrast and compare for a moment to the wives here, because Michelle Obama is really a fabulous campaigner. Did the Romney team have higher hopes for Ann Romney than what she was able to deliver?
They really did. She's another person who the people around her and her family and her closest friends and the campaign staff just think the world of her, and thought that she would be a great asset, kind of a potential first lady and someone who could kind of testify on her husband's behalf. From her convention speech to her appearances, there was no particular moment of controversy, as you saw with Michelle Obama in 2008, for instance, when she took a lot of heat for saying that she, for the first time in her adult life, she was proud of the voters. I'm paraphrasing there, but despite having no sort of major problem, Ann Romney sort of never really broke through, and she did have some moments, most of which are not remembered. We cite in the book. She did have some moments in media interviews where, in public appearances, where she did get a little bit upset, maybe a little bit tetchy at the media, which isn't always the smartest thing to do for a candidate or spouse. And so by the end, while, you know, she spent a lot of time campaigning and dealt with some physical problems, health problems, she didn't really do all the campaign had hoped for and anticipated she would do to kind of soften her husband and to have the public sort of listen to her testimony on his behalf.
Michelle Obama, on the other hand, is a real rock star when it comes to bringing in money, isn't she?
She was a great fundraiser and a great campaigner. And unlike 2008, when she was kind of a very reluctant conscript on the president's behalf, she didn't really have a lot of enthusiasm for the first race. She decided in this case that the president needed to be reelected, I think, to defend his legacy, to not be seen as kind of an historical one-term accident of history. And so she, while she was a little bit resistant to do much campaigning in the midterm in 2010, in 2012 she was all in as an extraordinary fundraiser for the president, but also as a campaigner. And the president's political team just delighted in the fact that she was willing to go out there and be so aggressive on his behalf, because she was so popular, not just at large, but specifically with some of the most important groups, young women and African Americans, the president was really relying on to build a coalition.
You start the book with those debates, the president losing the first debate pretty badly, but then information that most of us don't know about, that he wasn't doing very well in the preparation for the second debate. He said to his staff, did you ever know me to lose two in a row? But they were worried that he was going to lose two in a row.
Absolutely. This is one of the sort of the biggest revelations in the book, both in terms of making news, but also a real insight into President Obama and how he approaches politics, how he approaches public performance, and a rare moment for him, in our experience, of expressing doubt. Normally, as you said, basically his attitude is, if I lose, I'm not going to lose two in a row. But he was having such a hard time wrapping his head around how to prepare for the debate that one day before that critical second debate, he told his advisors in the scene that they described, referred to as an intervention, that he wasn't sure he could do it. He wasn't sure he'd be any better in the second debate than he was in the first debate. And the discussion he has with them in this intervention about the phoniness of debates and the lack of a second-term agenda from his point of view and his feelings about Governor Romney, all of it added up to making his team very nervous and very unconfident that he would do any better in the second debate. And they believed if his performance was as bad in the second debate as in the first debate, there was a real chance he could lose the election. Voters, they thought, were willing to forgive one bad performance, but another bad kind of lethargic performance that didn't seem to indicate the president was particularly engaged in another term would really hurt him with voters.
Now, what do you think?
That would it have hurt him?
Yes.
Oh, I think it would have. I think that it would have raised real questions about his engagement, particularly if Governor Romney had been as strong. And you recall that that second debate was a town meeting. And for the president to have a bad debate with voters in that setting, I think it would have really given Governor Romney a chance to narrow the gap on the question of cares about people like me. In the practice session that we write about in great detail in the book, where the president performed so badly, this was 2 days before the second debate, one day before their intervention with him, one of his advisors taking notes about how the president was interacting with aides who were standing in as real voters asking questions, described the way the president was interacting with him as creepy. And I think had that sort of carried forward to the actual debate, there's a good chance that the outcome would have been in serious jeopardy for him.
What did he mean, Mark, when you quote him as saying, I'm wired in a different way than this event requires?
Kathleen, that's the kind of one of the big dramatic statements he makes in this intervention, where he's expressing to them, again, part of the difficulty he had. They wanted his debate answers to be kind of in the tradition of, you know, again, the theatricality and phoniness of debates, kind of one-liner, like start your answer with a pithy one-liner, say a few more things, and then hit again with a one-liner and get off the answer. The president said, my brain's wired differently. I'm a constitutional law professor. I like to give long nice, discursive answers and build my arguments and have my thesis at the end rather than leading with it and not have these pre-canned cracks to try to rile up the audience. All of that, it's just stuff that's foreign to him. And in fact, one of the kind of dirty little things about Barack Obama's political career is he's not a great debater. He's never been a great debater. He's often not a very good speaker, in part because he eschews applause lines. He doesn't like the one-liner and the attack. He likes to build an argument. And all that's really admirable, and his aides, you know, didn't come as a surprise to them when he said, this is the stuff I think's phony. But when he said, I'm not sure I can do this, that's when they were quite unsettled because, again, just one day before the critical second debate, the president wasn't giving up, but he certainly was suggesting that as he puzzled out why he was having such a hard time, it wasn't leading him to a good place. It was leading him to kind of resignation of, I'm just not sure my brain is wired to do this any better than I've been doing.
Mm. I love the quote from the debate coach for that second, fast and hammy. You got to be fast and hammy. And my thought was, this guy is never fast and hammy. Hammy, he must have cringed when he heard that advice.
Well, he at that point, he was so low and so desperate to find a way out of his predicament that he did take it, even though, as you suggested, typically he'll talk slowly and not theatrically, but with purpose. But he took to that stage direction. They wrote him some one-liners, and he just kind of accepted, you know, I got to get through this debate. David Plouffe, one of his top political aides, said basically, you know, Mr. President, there's two debates left. You know, they're 90 minutes. You talk about half the time. You got to do about 80 minutes total of solid debate performance. You'll get a whole other term. You just got to focus for that period. And the president did do that. And in fact, they would yell fast and hammy at him to remind him to talk faster and be more theatrical and sell the lines. And on occasion in that prep, he'd say a line, you know, correctly, and the aides would show their approval, and the president would say, "That was fast and hammy, wasn't it?" He got into it.
We welcome more phone calls. We have to talk about the president's relationship with Wall Street, because there are really mixed thoughts about that, perhaps depending on what your political persuasion is. What did the president think of Wall Street? What did Wall Street think of the president? Is it a cozy relationship? Can you be a president without having a close relationship with Wall Street? We'll talk about that with Mark and other subjects as well. This hour of the program, the co-author of Double Down, Game Change 2012, which is about the 2012 campaign. It's been getting a lot of publicity. It's very well written and really filled with all kinds of information and fun to read as well. Mark Halperin is one of the authors. Mark is an editor at large, senior political analyst for Time Magazine, and a senior political analyst for MSNBC, has covered many presidential elections. Some of you may have had a chance to read this, and some of you may want to read it after you hear the interview, but we all lived through the campaign of 2012, so your thoughts about the advice the president was receiving, the advice that Mitt Romney was receiving, the vetting of Chris Christie, the debates, the people who performed well. This list, I found this very interesting that we started the show with, the yellow legal pad list that the president said, these are the issues that are near and dear to me, and I want to focus on them more during the next 4 years. And as I look at that list and see what he's been focusing on, there's a bit of a disparity. Energy and climate change, poverty among African Americans, Hispanics, Native Americans, and poor whites, Israel and Palestine, Guantanamo Bay, gay marriage, there's been a lot on that front, certainly. Do you see a difference between the way he's governed and those issues that he really wanted to have more prominence during the second administration? We'd like to hear from you. Did I tell you how to reach us? 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. And our Facebook page, where you're always welcome to leave messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We got lots of calls coming in, so let's, before we get to Wall Street, which we will, I promise, we'll take some calls. Michael in Superior is our next caller for you, Mark. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Mark. I got to tell you, I became a fan of Morning Joe the last couple of years, and I've enjoyed you on that program very much.
Michael, thank you so much. It's nice of you to watch.
Yeah, my question for you, and not just for you and Heilman, the people that you interview, how do you sift through the political bias that folks have, and in some cases need to have, to be passionate about what they're doing and working over, you know, the course of an election cycle? You know, how do you sift through that in order to give, you know, what you would think of, or we would think of, as an unbiased or a fairly centrist view of what happened?
Michael, it's a great question, and something all reporters have to deal with. You know, we have an advantage, a couple of advantages that makes it a little bit easier for us. One is 500 interviews. You start to get a pretty full picture of what happened. So you're not relying just on people whose views might be colored by a bias. And second is, John and I have both been political reporters for a couple decades, and so we know the people we're covering often for a couple decades, and so we have a good ability to judge in any instance where the accurate accounts are coming from. In the end, you know, the motivation for somebody talking to us doesn't really matter. What matters is what the truth is, what the facts are, who's got an account that squares up with documents or other people's accounts or recordings. And so we have to struggle with that. But we assume that what their motivation is and their biases are don't matter, as long as we're confident we're getting with the accurate story. And that, again, is a lot easier if you're doing as many interviews as we do for these books.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Michael. I believe the First Lady also watches Morning Joe, doesn't she, while she's on her treadmill?
She does. You know, it's a pretty common thing for for presidents and first ladies to maybe fib a little bit about their media intake.
Right.
They don't want to be known as watching as closely as they often do. So the president likes a lot of blogs and some newspapers. The first lady watches a little bit more cable TV, as best we can tell.
And the president does watch ESPN?
The president's a big fan of ESPN, and President Bush brought a pretty good package of sports channels into the White House. And as our understanding is, President Obama resubscribed, kept those accounts going. He is a great sports fan, and it's funny because I've talked to two people in the last couple weeks as we've been out on the book tour who've interviewed the president in the White House, and both of them talked about how he would, before the interview, after football or baseball or basketball comes up, he can talk at great length about sports. And then people have seen that when he does his NCAA men's college basketball bracket. The president knows a lot about sports.
Right.
He really does.
Thanks, Michael, for your call. Judy in Madison, hi.
Oh, hi. Just wanted to say that I finished the book last night.
All right.
And my husband just called me from in the car and said, "You better turn on Kathleen Dunn." So to hear this interview, as
Judy,
a political junkie, I love the book, and it was a fun read as well, as I learned a lot. I have two questions, however. At the end of the book, it just sort of ends the night of the election, and there was no. I was waiting for some sort of story about Karl Rove's meltdown on Fox. That wasn't in the book. Or I had also heard the rumor that Romney had never written a concession speech, that he had only written his acceptance speech, and there was nothing in there about that. And I was just wondering, first of all, the Romney rumor, was that true? And the other is, why did you leave out the Karl Rove meltdown?
Judy, those are great questions. In the spirit of the holiday season, I'm going to forgive you for giving away the end of the book.
Giving away the end.
What you said about Governor Romney not writing a concession speech, I know that was out there as a thing, but it turned out, as we reported out, that it wasn't true. He had both a victory speech and a concession speech, although neither of them was particularly well-formed. I think that's what gave some people the impression they hadn't worked at all on a concession. And the other thing is, although he did think he was going to win, the other thing is, one of the things John and I face in writing these books is to not make the books, 1,000 pages. And so we look at important moments, and if we don't have anything to add, or it doesn't really fit in with the scene and the flow of the chapter, we don't necessarily include every little thing that happened. A lot of people saw what happened with Karl Rove on Fox, and we write about Karl Rove in the book a fair amount, and we had always assumed that we would include something about that moment in the book. But as we did our reporting about it, as we kind of unpacked what happened in public and what happened behind the scenes, we didn't really feel we had much to add that was particularly compelling. And we, our rule is to write only about things that are interesting, important, funny, emotional. Mm-hmm. And there was nothing we had to add to that scene that we felt met that standard as compared to some of the other things we included.
Right. Okay. No, thanks for writing the book. It was fun. Are you going
nice,
to do it again
nice
in 4 years?
Excellent question. As we say in the TV business, stay tuned.
Stay tuned.
John and I have we've really been heartened by the reaction to both books, and we have fun doing them. But they're a lot of work, and we're busy trying to get people to read this one, perhaps give it to everybody on their holiday gift list. So until the sort of process of talking to people about Double Down finishes, we're not really focused on the future, but you're nice to ask.
Yeah, thank you, Judy, very much. I'm glad you were listening after having just finished it last night. I want to talk about Wall Street for a moment. Here's another thing where there are so many perceptions about whether or not the president is in bed with Wall Street or if he's not. You write, and I'm not doing justice to all here, but let's just start with one of the sentences. Even more than they disdained Obama's people, the Wall Streeters hated his policies. A lot of people would say, well, they like him, and he likes them, and they're tied at the hip.
Well, certainly one of the frustrations the president has had throughout his presidency is when he is criticized by some groups, like Wall Street, on both the left and the right, his view is, boy, these people are complaining when I could be a lot tougher on them. There certainly was a public appetite for a lot of anger at Wall Street in the wake of the financial crisis. But, you know, a lot of people on Wall Street don't like and haven't liked the president's policies. They also haven't liked his rhetoric. And his relationship with them was quite troubled, and it had an impact both in terms of his legislative agenda and then in terms of reelection. The amount of money he was raising on Wall Street was nothing like what he'd raised in 2008. And the president's team wanted to fix it, but based, again, on their anger at his policies and his rhetoric, eventually they decided that there was only so much they could do, and they'd need to figure out a way to raise money without the same kind of mammoth contribution from Wall Street they'd had 4 years earlier.
Mm. Well, let's go back to where we started the interview, and that's all those items on that yellow legal pad list, which I found so interesting. Isn't it interesting that when you look at what's been going on, you know this better than anybody, not much has been going on, and the issues have to do with the budget and with the debt, and there's nothing on immigration reform, and we had a government shutdown, and there really hasn't been a whole lot going on, at least the last couple of years. With his administration, everything seems dysfunctional. What is the presidential response to that? What is your response to that? Can this president, a couple of years from now, look back on these 4 years and say, I finally did deal with some of those issues on that yellow legal pad?
You know, I think it's going to be very hard for him, in part because as long as Republicans control the House, and I think they're likely to for the balance of his term, not a sure thing, but looks that way right now, it's going to be difficult to pass anything like climate change or immigration reform, or major poverty, anti-poverty program that the president feels so strongly about. At the same time, Democrats are not all that happy with him either. He's lost a lot of allies in the Democratic Party, although he still has quite a few. So I think it's not hyperbolic to say that that's something dramatic. It's somewhat difficult to see how the president moves on any of the elements on his list, domestic policy, that was on that yellow legal pad, or anything else of a substantial nature, unless things change somewhat. I like to joke that, you know, perhaps if the president was able to successfully repel a Martian invasion, he might be able to rally the country and the Congress around him. But short of something dramatic like that, I do worry that there's a possibility, and the problems with the health care rollout only exacerbate this. I think there's a possibility that the president's second term will largely be more framing of political fights and not addressing any of the big challenges the country faces right now. We've never seen anything like that, not at least in my career, of an entire term which is devoted just to political fighting and posturing and name-calling as opposed to some significant accomplishments.
And, Mark, how do you explain what's happened with the Affordable Care Act? How did everything go so wrong?
Well, I think the president is not a huge hands-on manager. He's a pretty big delegator, and it's pretty clear that there was insufficient attention, to say the least, to the mechanics of the website. I think it's also the case that the president did not get a big mandate for the healthcare system that he's passed into law, in part because Governor Romney didn't really raise it as an issue. It wasn't because he had his own issues with healthcare because he passed a similar plan in Massachusetts. So I think that we're seeing now a lot of areas where the president, for political reasons, was not as full-throated in explaining how the law would work. For instance, one of the things that's become controversial, that some people, not huge, huge numbers, but some people would lose their individual policies and not be able to keep what they wanted. They're going to be losers under Obamacare, and patients and providers, et cetera. And I think As the website didn't work, and as the controversy over canceled policies took place, kind of a double whammy, I think.
Yeah.
I think it's reinforced the notion of the divide in the country.
Yes, it has. Thank you, Mark, so much. Great book, and thanks for the conversation. Happy Thanksgiving. Mark Halperin, our guest. Thanks to KP Whaley and Lisa Nalbandian for producing this interesting hour.